Good morning. This is Brian Clark, CEO of Greater Philadelphia Health Action, holding a call today to review financials, review third quarter financials, as that's what we have prepared as of today, and also give you an update on what our projections are for the close of the year. I trust that everyone has a copy of the financials that were sent out for the third quarter, and I'll start with the activity report, which shows the number of users that we have, or patients, at 84,349, and this is the first time in a very, very long time, decades, that we've had a drop in the number of patients. As you can see, that last year we closed the year out of 88,000, and we're down to 84,349 as of September 20th. And that should be expected. That's a direct result of COVID and the fact that we have unfortunately been challenged, like every other business, with new patients, particularly for that where poor folks was told to shelter in place or stay at home. We experienced a material drop in the number of new patients coming on board, as well as visits, patients coming in for visits. And that's come back a bit and then sort of normalized itself as we made it through the summer and into the fall. But we have less patients today as a result of that. And further down the page, you can see our visits. And our visits, bill of total encounters are 202,979. And again, that's compared to the 219,000 that we had same time prior year. And again, tied directly to what I just mentioned was the drop in visits, that caused a drop in patients, that also causes a drop in visits. Now, not all those visits were patients that we've lost. Those were just visits of patients that were scheduled to come in on routine visits, or potentially that would have been in through the allergy season, as an example, for seasonal allergies, you know, annual physicals, physical visit type that we lost, sort of spanned the gambit of all visits. But again, it was all directly tied to the shelter-in-place orders that were here in place in the city of Philadelphia and across the state of Pennsylvania. Fortunately, folks did heed the advice of the governor to stay at home. That impacted us from about 17,000 visits. Again, those visits have gotten more normal in the months leading out of the summer into the fall. So we're sort of back to our normal course of business. However, about 70% of our visits are taking place through telehealth. As we've gotten our telehealth process robustly set up with providers, support staff that are working remotely, which allows for them to stay home and stay safe, as well as for patients to stay home and stay safe. And we can't perform all the visits we like to be able to perform through telehealth, just because a good portion of our visits we still have to observe you in person, taking vitals, taking measurements of height, weight, particularly of small children, giving vaccinations, drawing blood and the like. And so those things have interrupted as a result of COVID. And again, just to recap, that's about 4,000 visits, patients were off, 4,000 patients, and about 17,000 visits that were off. As you can see further down the next page, rather, which is our statement of revenue and expenditures, the grant support is $7,514,000. Total revenues sit at $46,780,000, and giving us total support and revenue of $54,294,579. And $586,000 which gives us an operating income of $6,708,000, which is, again, rather healthy, even considering considering that we have, we're in the year of COVID. And if you compare on the next page to budget, you can see that our patient fees are actually slightly up. About $1.4 million in patient fees that are up. And although our visits are down and materially down as a result of COVID, we have a couple of things working in our favor. We did have a rate increase that we applied for last year. And so our rate, our payment rate is higher, which is actually helping helping our patient fees, as well as some of our measures that we perform on, bonus dollars that we get paid from the managed care companies or the HMOs. Those are outcomes from 19 that got paid in 20. And so there's some good things happening there, which is causing our visits to be up. Had we had COVID, I should say, then you would have expected to see another $3 million, somewhere in that range, more in patient fees. So although we're overperforming our budget, it would have been, materially over if not for COVID. Pharmacy. Daycare is down slightly, $124,000. Our pharmacy business is up pretty significantly, although our visits are down. But pharmacy is up in large part because we have a couple of things working for us. We have one of our locations is going gangbusters in pharmacy. It's a special population of very sick people that are on a lot of medications. And so that's a special population. But across the board, we have we're adding more patients to our pharmacy as a result of COVID, and because we're doing telehealth visits, we can deliver scripts to our patients. Where before, a patient may, you have another pharmacy, they may use a Rite Aid or Walgreens or CVS or a small, what we call mom and pop pharmacy. And as a result of COVID and the interest of staying home and sheltering in place, we've script to the patient. So if they had opted to stay with their traditional pharmacy, then they would have to leave their home to go and pick the script up. We offer delivery of no cost to the patient, and as a result, we're filling thousands and thousands of more scripts per month than what we were under prior to COVID, and as a result, we have more revenue. And so our total support and revenue actual over budget is $3.6 million. And, in total, our net profit, or we're exceeding our net profit budget by $1.5 million in total. And again, that's being driven by the surplus in revenue, our reimbursement rate, as well as our scripts, which I stated earlier. And we've actually received quite a bit of funding from the federal government through the CARES Act. About $4 million in funding, all of which we haven't actually drawn down, some of which we have, and so that's actually helped out a lot as well with keeping staff on board, being able to continue the high-quality services that we have, certainly setting up the apparatus for testing, because we're testing at all of our sites. Two of our sites actually have tents up and outdoor testing, where you can drive up or walk up without having to come into the facility as we were in the summer and fall months where the weather is pretty decent in this region. And setting all that up, we were able to do so and use our funding from the federal government in that process, which has worked out rather nicely. On the very last page, I'll just jump to, we have our balance sheet, and our total current assets are $48,319,000. Total assets of $79,841,000. Liabilities of $62,893,000, giving us a fund balance of $16,967,000, and total liabilities and fund balance of $79,841,000. And that's where we were as of September. Things are pretty much trending in that same direction for our year end. We expect to have these numbers basically grow in terms of our bottom line operating income over our budget. This will be a pretty good year for us relative to how we end the year with operating income, as well as how we're going to end the year in terms of our cash position, in terms of cash on hand, either cash sitting in that bank account or our undrawn grant dollars that we'll have to be drawn down in this year. And so, from a cash standpoint, we're in the best cash position we've been in ever in the history of the company. And that's again a combination of a couple of things that have taken place: our increase in rate, as well as the funding through the CARES Act. We've been fortunate, very fortunate, to be able to have telehealth visits. Our financial situation would be very different, because it would mean that patients would have to come into the building, and I'm not certain how many people would have actually shown up in person for those visits. And we're challenged with space and social distancing. One thing that telehealth allows us to do is to keep our buildings relatively empty and only see patients that need to be seen in person. If we had to go back to that setting, we would have been constrained by social distancing and inside of our own buildings, and that's in our waiting rooms, in our hallways, in our labs. And so it makes the telehealth allows us to be able to stay true to the social distancing, keeping our staff and our employees safe, our staff and our patients safe, excuse me. But at the same time, get the care that patients need, give them the referrals for x-rays or imaging or colonoscopies that they need for other entities for services we don't provide, get them their medications, which is very important, particularly for our chronically ill patients that we've been managing their care for quite some time. Being able to do a telephonic or video a visit and then get them their medications has been a lifesaver for our patients, and also for a healthy bottom line. And so with that, I will close out and ask if there are any questions or comments.
Hey, Brian, this is Stephen Levy from Prudential. Thank you so much for the call today, as always.
Hey, Stephen, how are you? Happy New Year to you.
You as well. I hope you and your family are safe.
Same here. We are, but thank you. Thank you so much.
Good to hear. A couple questions. So first, maybe you could talk about telehealth. So, clearly lots of hospitals and other providers are offsetting some of the declines in person with telehealth. So at present, what are you getting reimbursed from either Medicaid or the commercial payers that you do have at the kind of the same rate as you would an in-person visit?
That is 100% correct. The reimbursement rates have not changed. Rather, it's a face-to-face or in-person or telehealth. So the telehealth is as profitable margin-wise as a face-to-face visit is.
So fast forward, God willing, after this pandemic, I would imagine that some of your sicker patients, people that are less mobile, maybe will continue with some of the telehealth. So are your expectations that you think telehealth, A, is here to stay, and B, do you expect kind of the insurers to maybe differentiate going forward a little bit less on the reimbursement side for telehealth, or do you think it'll kind of just be the same?
So I'll answer that question two ways. Let's just talk about it from the patient standpoint. If left up to the patients, yes, telehealth will continue. They like it operationally. It's easier for us as an organization to do telehealth, but logistically, as you can imagine, it's easier for our patients to pick up their phone or pick up their sit at their computer versus, you know, catching a bus, subway, driving in, parking, walking, what have you, to get here. And so between the doctor and the patient, telehealth is fantastic and will certainly be a permanent staple of a patient's care. The issue will be if CMS at the federal level changes back to the previous guideline, which prevented Medicaid patients specifically from receiving telehealth, but only under some rare circumstances. As it stands now, the CMS sets the standard and the states and the managed care companies sort of follow suit. What I've been hearing from our state association is that telehealth is here to stay, particularly when you think about the damage that COVID has done, specifically to the underserved population, and that's, you know, the lion's share of the patients we take care of. We recognize that even folks with insurance, even though they may have insurance, for a myriad of reasons, have barriers to care or social determinants of health that made them prime targets for COVID, because they were perhaps overweight, diabetic, hypertensive, you know, and a litany of other chronic diseases. To go back to the way we were before, to essentially throw that another hurdle or throw that barrier back in their way, which is getting to your doctor, you know, physically getting your body to your doctor, the belief is that's sort of counterintuitive, and there's no reason to go back, because what we're seeing, and it's early in the process, is we don't see a drop in outcome, Stephen. So if managed care company says, oh, we're going to pay you less, then the argument will be, well, why are you paying us less? Is the patient, are the outcomes any different? If the outcomes are the same, we actually believe the outcomes are better because patients are getting more frequent touches. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Then why would we force their hands and say, well, drive back in or take the bus, make transportation be the barrier where in this technology world that we're in, it doesn't have to be. And so we really feel like caught up with the rest of all other industries, which have been using technology and distance in technology for a decade now. So we don't believe that it's going to go back. There may be some constraints, maybe things like you can't have two telehealth visits back-to-back, or you can't have certain visits in a telehealth environment. We expect to see some definitions being put out, but we believe that that telehealth is really here to stay. I'll give you one example on the behavioral health side. Patients that are being seen for, you know, drug and alcohol addiction or mental health, they, prior to COVID, were meeting with their therapist in person. And we still have patients that say, yes, I still choose to come in to meet. But the overwhelming majority of our patients, in the neighborhood of 97%, prefer the telehealth environment because they are not being examined physically by their therapist. The therapist likes to see facial expressions and body language, but that can all be observed through video. We have patients, Stephen, that are having their visits with their therapist at a private room at their office, in their car while they're on their lunch break. And the challenges of transportation or child doctor, traveling in the evenings, traveling in ice and snow, and all the obstacles that come into play all go out the window. We're seeing in a face-to-face environment where the show rate, the number of people that would show up, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 to 60%. We're seeing the show rates being in the neighborhood of 93% for our behavior health visits, which means people are getting more consistent care, and the outcomes, we believe, are going to show better than the face-to-face environment because the continuity is greater.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I mean, one of the things that we're hearing, it's a different industry, but in our charter schools with the remote, especially in the inner cities, is that a lot of families don't necessarily have the technology or the bandwidth to do it. So some of them are doing it on the phone. So I would imagine there's some limitations there if people don't have good access to, you know, a videos per se.
Correct. And that is 100% true. And what CMS has done, and the state of Pennsylvania needs to get some credit for it, is they're allowing for telephonic or video. So it could just be a phone call. You don't actually have to have a video.
Right.
And so that allows for, because practically everyone has a cell phone, that allows for that barrier that requires video, that requires a smart device, that requires Wi-Fi, that allows that barrier to be dropped. And again, it's left up to the doctor. We absolutely have providers that will tell patients, you were listed as telehealth, but based on the lump that you have on your back or the rash you have on your arm, or if you're pregnant, as an example, I need to see you. So this is going to be a very short visit because since I have you on the phone, but I need to have you come in because I need to observe you. And the 1,200 or so visits we have a day, it's fantastic, and I think it will continue that we're able to do about 70-75% of them through telehealth.
Good. Okay, so switching gears a little bit, can you talk about 340B and are you in line to see any changes that will be either positive or negative in the next year?
We actually believe that we're going to have positive change. There was a pushback about 6 months ago by AstraZeneca and I forget the other manufacturer, maybe in Gilead, where the two of them, based on an executive order that Trump signed, interpreted his executive order to mean that they could decide which pharmaceuticals could be processed through 340B. And if you recall, there was the EpiPen was one that they picked. And they said, we're not going to allow this to be 340B. And they just arbitrarily picked that one. And not just health centers, but 340B providers, which are mostly hospitals, pushed back and says, hey, you can't do that. The legislation says if you're a manufacturer, you need to sell to these particular providers under the 340B requirements, which allows us to purchase the drugs cheaper. You can't arbitrarily just decide which drugs. And so they said, well, there's this executive order, and there was some to and froing. And I got an email a week ago. I've been getting them maybe once every other week, but from our national association, who's been working with a law firm, who's working with the hospital association, and basically stating they actually instructed us to sue HRSA the way the Fed said, hey, you're going to have to list HRSA in the lawsuit, and that it will be the trigger for us to go back to the manufacturers and say, you can't do this. And then there's legislation pending that will come up in the next Congress that will prevent this kind of what we saw was a misuse or misinterpretation of the regs and make it more stringent, more consistent, more obvious, I'll say, more obvious that a manufacturer can't arbitrarily decide which drugs to use and apply under the 340B requirement. So that we were very concerned. Operationally, as you can imagine, EpiPens are very, very important. Not being able to get them under the 340B pricing was problematic. And if it just stopped there, it wouldn't be that big of a deal, Stephen. But you know how these things start. A manufacturer will pick one, and then 3 months later they'll pick 10, and before you know it, half of their drugs they'll say we're not going to sell through 340B. So we're very happy to see that we're making some progress with what we call these sort of rogue decisions that are being made. And it's all about money. At the end of the day, it's all about margin. They're trying to capture margin.
Of course. But, I mean, I'm not defending the other side of the coin, but some of these hospitals and other organizations take the most expensive drugs, and then they know they're going to get more in terms of reimbursement. So something that might have been generic won't be prescribed because the provider will make more if they prescribe something more expensive. So ultimately, the federal government eats that. So, I mean, there's another side of the story as well.
Yeah, there is. And that's, the legislation is overarching, but there's some specifics that it doesn't call out. And we're hoping that with this upcoming Congress that we actually get some language that is very clarifying to all, so it doesn't leave things sort of ambiguous.
Got it. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And then lastly, related to the pharmacy, do you do mail order?
We deliver through mail your pharmaceuticals. You can't request it through mail. You still have to have a visit with the doctor.
Right, of course. But yeah. If someone wants it done through the mail, then you'll do that.
Absolutely. And we've been doing a lot more of that as a result of COVID and as a result of being in a telehealth environment, which is why our pharmacy businesses continue to grow, even in a year where our visits are down. It's sort of counterintuitive, but we're actually getting more patients switching from their traditional pharmacies to us because we're on telehealth and we let them know we'll deliver it to you within the next 24 to 48 hours.
Okay, and in terms of Medicaid, what you're hearing from the Commonwealth for next year, obviously a lot is in flux with the new administration, whether there'll be more aid forthcoming to the state and local governments. What are your expectations for Medicaid next year, just kind of generally?
We believe there's going to be more funding. It's going to be, we think, more targeted directly at vaccine and the administration of vaccines. Just to give you and the other bondholders some clarity, we get the vaccine for free. So the vaccine itself doesn't cost us anything. But the administration of the vaccine, literally putting it in the arm, actually has a cost, and it's not obvious. If you were to come in today and we were to vaccinate you, literally we'd have to have the refrigeration or the freezing to keep the vaccine at a certain temperature. And then that vaccine would have to be given to you by, a nurse or a medical assistant, and a provider needs to be around in the area, in the building, for an observation, because we just don't stick it in your arm and send you on the way because some folks have had allergic reactions or a myriad of challenges with the vaccine, and it's a small percentage. We as a medical provider have to observe you, which means you have to literally sit for 15 to 20 minutes, and we have to make sure that you're okay and you're on your way. The logistics behind all of that cost money, right? That's labor, that's time, and in COVID, space is an issue because of social distancing. So my constraints around how many vaccines could I deliver is not just how many doses I have. It's also
right, of course.
How much labor can I afford to dedicate it, because I'm not billing for a vaccine injection. And what we have, at health centers have been asking for HRSA for is special funding around vaccinating. Because every time I vaccinate, I have to trade visits. 10 billable encounters that I could have had in this, 2 hour period that now have to be vaccination encounters, and I can't bill for them. And so it isn't just the cost of the vaccine or the labor, it's also the opportunity cost to generate another billable visit.
Well, of course.
It puts providers in a very tough place where we have to sit back and say, wow, we want to do so many vaccinations, but the question is, how many can we afford to do? How many continuity visits can we not have and take that resource, labor, and space and dedicate that toward vaccinations, which don't generate billable visits? And it's an awful place to be as a provider because you have two legitimate patients that you want to take care of, the continuity patient as well as the vaccine patient. And there lies the challenge, and that's why we believe we are seeing a slower pace in the vaccinations than what everyone thought, because the rate limiting step isn't necessarily the number of dosages. It's also the labor and resource around vaccination. And so we really have been asking CMS to do two things: keep telehealth going, and give us a separate funding for vaccinations. And it could either be, or we could submit it at the end of some period of time and get reimbursed. We need a way to be able to not lose money while we're doing the very important work of vaccinating the public.
Got it. Thank you so much for that. So that's all I had. I greatly appreciate, obviously, your time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Any other questions or points of clarity?
Hi, this is Larry Bellinger from AllianceBernstein. Just to follow up real quickly on CMS and billing for vaccinations, are you also seeking some reimbursement money from the next stimulus as part of this for vaccinations? And let me ask you this: could you seek some reimbursements from the latest stimulus that was just passed?
So the first answer, let me answer the first one, the last question first. And the stimulus that just passed, we received funding for labor and for testing. There wasn't any funding specifically for vaccinations. What we are hoping to get and the next round is specific funding around the vaccines, which was not in the first nor was it in the most recent passage that came out, I guess, just before the election. And so there wasn't any funds for the administrative vaccines. It wasn't because it wasn't asked. There was this belief that, well, that's going to be on the states. That's up to the states. But in a very practical sense, it still costs money to do, and the states don't have the funds to push down to providers to cover those costs. And so we're hopeful that in the next round there will be vaccine administration part of that conversation, and certainly, you know, hospitals need to be part of the conversation, and even places like CVS and Walgreens, you know, any pharmacy can do vaccine administration, but they need to be compensated for it, because there is no billing mechanism to an insurance company for just the administration piece of a vaccine.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Great. Well, I appreciate the two gentlemen that asked questions. If anybody else has any questions, they could certainly shoot over an email. We will be, I think the next time we meet, we'll have our audited financial statements, I guess, in about 5 or 6 months. And I'm sure there'll be more to talk about with COVID and vaccines, and hopefully, you know, the infection rates will be down by then, and the death rates will be down by then, and we'll be, you know, at the beginning, or at the end of this phase, and really probably at the beginning of what we like to think to be the new normal. But if there are no other questions or comments, this concludes this call. Thank you very much.
The conference has been terminated by the moderator.